Good afternoon, and welcome to the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society's The Best of NERA 2007 online program, broadcast on www.sechistorical.org. I'm Lawrence Mitchell, Theodore Reinhardt Professor of Business Law at the George Washington University Law School, and author of the forthcoming The Speculation Economy, How Finance Triumphed Over Industry, and I'm today's moderator for the program. As our listeners may know, the SEC Historical Society preserves and shares the history of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission and of the securities industry through its virtual museum and archive, available at www.sechistorical.org. The museum's collections of over 2,000 primary materials, not easily available through other online sources, are free and accessible worldwide at all times. The Virtual Museum and Archive, as well as the Society, is separate and independent of the SEC and receives no federal funding. It's my privilege today to welcome members of the staff of NERA Economic Consulting, presenting what have been deemed the top presentations from their recent Finance, Law, and Securities Litigation Seminar. This is the fourth annual Best of NERA program broadcast by the SEC Historical Society. Past Best of NERA programs can be accessed through the online program section of the Virtual Museum and Archive at any time. Joining with me today are Dr. Sharon Brown-Horoska, NERA Vice President, Dr. Patrick Conroy, also a NERA Vice President and a participant in last year's Best of NERA, and Dr. Robert Mackey, NERA Senior Vice President. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I would like to thank NERA Economic Consulting for its generous sponsorship of today's program. Its support, along with gifts and grants from many other institutions and individuals, is helping to make possible the growth and outreach of the virtual museum this year. The remarks made today are solely those of the speakers and are not representative of the society. Our speakers cannot give legal or investment advice. Sharon, Pat, and Robert, welcome.
Thank you.
And Pat, why don't we start with you?
Thank you, Lawrence. It's nice to be here. Being a former SEC staffer, today I'm going to talk about securities trading, and it reminded me a little bit back when I first got to the SEC. My first assignment, the chief economist at the time, Eric Seary, gave me a task of analyzing something called 12G32B stocks. And being a new staff member, of course, I said absolutely, which meant absolutely I have no idea what those are, but absolutely. It turns out they were foreign bulletin board stocks that are listed in the United States. Today we're going to talk about specialist trading of New York Stock Exchange stocks, which are obviously much bigger and well-known throughout the world, but just about as complicated to understand how they work. And I think even though people are aware of them generally, a lot of the details of how they get traded only have come to light recently with all the specialist trading cases that took place on the New York Stock Exchange. Stepping back for a second, I mean, in general at NERA, over the last few years, we've got an increasing number of very complex trading cases, insider cases dealing with mutual funds, hedge funds, options trading and options execution quality, commodities, pipes, ECNs, cross-trading, which is trading across accounts within a brokerage. So and a lot of these cases have very large data sets as well. So the specialist case we're going to be talking about is a trading case, which is not dissimilar from others in a lot of the issues that you deal with. The data you're using, the context of the trading, and the type of analysis you're going to do to show what truly happened in the market at that time. In all of the trading cases, it seems to be an overriding question. And the question is, for the given quantity that was traded, was it executed at the right price, and was it executed at the right time? And that's where a lot of these cases start. The specialist cases came about when the government brought charges against 15 different specialists on the New York Stock Exchange for a certain pattern of trading which they deemed violated the rules. I'm going to go into explaining briefly what type of trading it was, but let me just preface it and tell you what the outcome of all of the 15 specialist cases were. Two of the specialists were found guilty. One was found guilty by jury and then acquitted. Two pled guilty. One was acquitted by the jury. One fled the country. And eight of the cases were dropped. And given that laundry list of different outcomes, it's clear it wasn't a very easy thing to understand, and that even for the ones that were found guilty, the facts differed among them. Some had conspiracy charges, whereas others did not, which may have been made part of the difference. So it doesn't seem straightforward. So what is the specialist? Really briefly, of course, the specialist is an employee who makes markets in stocks on the New York Stock Exchange. These are not owned by the exchange or run by the exchange. They are separate companies. And a bit of history is that the specialist came about in the 1800s when one of the traders was injured, broke his leg, and was sitting in a chair. And they sat him in the chair and basically had him trade one stock all day. And that seemed to work out pretty well, and the system evolved. So you have specialists who, for instance, in one of the specialist cases, traded only GE and traded GE all day. What were they accused of? Two things. One thing called trading ahead, and one called interpositioning. Trading ahead was simply when the specialist traded before a public order, and the public order then received inferior fill. And an interpositioning trade is simply when there were two orders that arrived to the specialist at the same time. The specialist, instead of crossing those orders, would buy from one and then sell to the other, making a profit because the buy price is lower than the sell price. I'll give a quick numerical example of that later. How did the government make its case? Well, it was very complex, with a lot of computer algorithms that they created and a number of assumptions about how the data came into the DTC system. They showed that a certain percentage of trades made by the specialists were interpositioning trades. The assumptions made in the algorithm were varied because what they were trying to show is a snapshot of something that was going on, which was actually really a flow in time. Let me give you an example of the screenshots that they would produce. They might find one trade which they thought was an interpositioning trade via the rules of their algorithm. That trade might have transpired over 5 seconds, but in that 5 seconds there could literally be thousands of screenshots in order to show the sequence of what was going on. And in fact, the trade that was singled out as an interpositioning trade might only have been one of hundreds of trades that were taking place over that time period. So it was very difficult to understand out of context what an interpositioning trade looked like. An example is, suppose Derek Jeter of the Yankees is accused of not fielding the ball properly in order to throw games. So what you do is you take very close-up snapshots of him. You see the ball coming, you see it bounce up, you see it go right over his glove. And so your conclusion is he missed it on purpose. But you didn't see all the other things that were going on around then. Fans yelling, another runner trying to steal second base. And so out of context, it's very difficult to understand what's going on in the game. Same is true of the specialists. Going back, the government said that investors had an expectation that they would receive the best price, and therefore the specialists made illegal profits by interpositioning. The defense countered in a number of ways. They said, well, sometimes the specialist wasn't at his post. The specialist doesn't actually do all the trades. There are clerks that enter the trades. Also, a lot of it may not have been deliberate. People make mistakes. It's a very fast market. It's very complex. Even a skilled professional makes mistakes sometimes. And then there were some more subtle things, that the screenshots weren't real, and showing those to a jury wasn't going to be a real depiction of the activity on the floor and what the specialist was having to deal with. So let me go back and give you a quick numerical example of an interpositioning, and then conclude by telling you how the case came out. Again, if there was a trade where the current bid is at $100 and the ask price is $101, and two orders come in at the same time, each to buy 500 shares, a few outcomes could happen. First, they could both sell at $100.50. Second, the buy order could go for $100 and the sell order for $101, and there would be a dollar profit. And the third, the specialist could execute one of the orders at $100.25 and the other order at $100.75 and capture 50 cents of the profit. So again, even interpositioning is not quite clear. Was the investor, would the investor be expected to be executed at the bid or the ask, or inside the bid and the ask? There are no clear rules on that. After all the evidence came forward, one of the specialists in particular was found guilty by the jury. But the judge overturned that and acquitted. There were a number of reasons why that was done. First of all, some of the reasons cited were that there's a crowd involvement in trading on the New York Stock Exchange. So it was clear that there were times when the specialist may not have been paying attention to the electronic orders coming in, but may have been talking with the crowd. The government contention was always that the legs of the trade, meaning the first trade of the IP and the second trade of the IP, were very close together. In fact, sometimes it was many seconds before different legs of the trade passed. There were times when the specialist wasn't even at the post, perhaps had gone to lunch, or the bathroom, other things, when these alleged IPs took place. And oftentimes there were intervening trades between legs of an IP. So the first trade would be executed, then the specialist would execute other trades, and then the second matching trade would be executed. But the algorithm didn't take account of the intervening trades, only the two legs. And finally, it was often the case that while the government's algorithm might be easy to look at and say 100 shares executed against another 100 shares, making it a nice clean transaction, that the two sides of the leg were mismatched. The buy side could have been 5,000 shares and the sell side only 400 shares, showing an interpositioning of 400 shares. So there were a good number of reasons why the judge came up with the overturning. In general, I think that this was a good example of a very complex trading analysis. It had many issues that the jury had to understand that were outside of what one would expect a regular person to understand. And it's likely that we'll be getting more of these types of trading analysis in the future.
Thanks, Matt. That was really fascinating in one of what I think is one of the most arcane and difficult to understand aspects of securities trading there is. And I look forward to asking you some questions later. Bob?
Yes. Thank you, Norris. The title of my talk is Recent Allegations of Manipulation in Commodity Markets. And the recent needs to be qualified since this talk was prepared for a NERA conference a month ago. And I'm not referring to the recent show cause orders and complaints filed by the CFTC and the FERC, although I'll have a few things to say about it. It's not quite that recent. If we turn to commodity market manipulation, there's the traditional forms of commodity market manipulation that we're somewhat familiar with, the corner or the squeeze, where a long participant in the market, for example, builds up a very large long position in some commodity, let's say silver or soybeans, and simultaneously is able to acquire a dominant position in the deliverable commodity. And then as the contract goes to expiration, the long stands for delivery. As the shorts scramble to find the commodity, they can't find it since the long owns it. And the long is unable to extract a high price from the shorts to get out of the market. Maybe this is what was going on in the Hunt Silver case, as some have alleged, and maybe some of this was going on in the recent Sumitomo Copper litigation that drug on for over a decade. But I really want to talk more about some new forms of manipulation that are in some sense variations on the traditional corner or squeeze and variations on the old rumor. That is, you can manipulate the market by spreading a false rumor. Related to the traditional corner or squeeze is recent concern the CFTC has expressed about trading in a way that exacerbates market congestion. And they've brought investigations into cases in which they allege that traders know the market's congested, and rather than sort of backing off or not doing anything, they actually trade into that congestion and make it worse. And there's concerns on their part that may well constitute manipulation. I think, in fact, the the recent CFTC complaint that came out last week and the FERC complaint charging manipulation by Amaranth in the CFTC's case in the expiration of two contract months, and in FERC in three, are taking this even to one step further, to where basically they're talking about slamming or jamming the close of the contract, that is postponing trading till the last 8 minutes, for example, of trading in that, so as to affect the settlement price on the NYMEX contract, which is then used to settle various over-the-counter or contracts traded on another exchange. So that's another type of manipulation that really I think we're going to see a lot more of, and there's a lot of current investigations ongoing beyond just the Amaranth complaint. Well, the one I want to focus on really is it's a variant of the rumor case. And over the last few years, there's been allegations that participants in the commodity markets, and in particular in the natural gas markets, deliberately misreported either their trades or the prices at which they traded to the industry trade publications, who collect these prices and create indices that they then publish. Those indices, by the way, are frequently used to settle certain contracts. And in fact, I believe over two dozen firms settled for over $300 million with the CFTC with respect to their alleged misreporting of these trades. Not surprisingly, class action suits followed. And there was a major class action suit alleging that these firms their misreporting in the cash market led to a manipulation of the NYMEX futures contract. So that's really was the hypothesis. And let's see if we can, you know, as an example, think about how one might go about analyzing that. Now, it's certainly true that news can have a major impact on prices. A good example from the commodity markets is the fact that, let's just take natural gas storage reports. They come out once a week. They're widely watched, widely anticipated. And when the report turns out to be different than what the market anticipated, the market moves. And it can move significantly in that case. In fact, there's a notorious example of this going back to November of 2004, when the EIA, which is the Energy Information Agency, reported that the storage was 32 billion cubic feet lower than expected. This was right after Thanksgiving. In the course of that day, the prompt month price rallied over $1.50 from around $6.50, and the spread to the next month narrowed dramatically in response to that announcement. Well, it turned out that report was incorrect. One of the firms that was filing the report just put down the wrong number. Within 4 days, the market corrected that, and the price had already traded off some, but it fell a dollar. So there's a nice example in which news, in this case it happened to be incorrect news, really move the market. So it's certainly possible that putting out an incorrect index through Platts could have an impact on the market. But I think it's important to realize that when Platts publishes an index that says natural gas trading at Henry Hub or at some other delivery point was at an average price of X yesterday, that's not the only information that the market participants have, because market participants are seeing not only their own quotes, their own trades, they're also seeing what the brokers tell them. And those that want to bother, for example, could pull up the Intercontinental Exchange Terminal and watch cash trading all day, basically. So participants in this market don't wait to read Platts when it comes out to find out what's going on. They actually have their own observations of what's happening. So the real question then is, to what extent is there something in Platts that's different from what the market is observing, and does that news, let's call that difference news, does that news impact the futures market? Well, how might we go about testing that? I want to lay out sort of three ways in which we can do that. One kind of draws on the analogy with the release of the EIA report. The Platts surveys market participants starting around 12:30 at the end of cash trading. They survey for a few hours. They stop surveying. They then process the survey, and around 8 o'clock at night, they send out by fax or by email, they send out the index to their subscribers. If the traders really thought there was important information in that publication, they could be sitting at their desk and they could get it, open it up, read it, and trade on it, just like they do when the EIA announces storage reports. Or at a minimum, when they show up the next morning at 6 o'clock and they look at it, they could start trading. And in fact, they can trade on it. They can trade, if they get it at night, they can trade on the Access electronic system at NYMEX, or they could at the time these allegations were made. And it turns out, actually, that this, if you look at the storage report releases, they really have a major impact on volatility. There was a wonderful study done by a couple of economists that looked at the volatility around the time when the around 2 o'clock, basically, when the storage reports came out. And you find, if you go back historically, there's a real spike in volatility in the market. And it's even more interesting than that, because the EIA changed when it reported from in the afternoon to in the morning, and the spike in volatility just moved right to in the morning. So if something real is going on, it'll show up in the data, and you can see it. Well, one way to check then is to see, does anything happen during the night to volatility when Platts is released? So we actually we went and we looked. We calculated 5-minute rolling volatility, and we wanted to see overnight, was there a spike when the report was released? And there was none. In fact, it looks like just a total flat line. So that was one way to try to see if the release of the report had any impact. Well, you might think, well, okay, well, maybe not at night, but when the traders come in the next morning, they get the report, maybe they start trading on it. And if they do trade on that information, then it ought to show up in the futures returns that day. So a second way to try to test for this is to see, well, wait a minute, is the news in the report, that is the difference between the Platts report and, let's say, a benchmark of prices that could have been observed in the market, that's the news, is that news correlated with the futures returns? Well, it turns out that if you actually look at that correlation, there's a correlation between the news and the futures open-to-open return. And that's kind of interesting. It's actually a statistically significant return, and that might make you think, oh, there's something to this. Now, the only problem with that is if you this report comes out at night, it could be read in the morning. So if it's going to have an impact, it seems like it should have an impact on the closed-to-open return. But when you look at that correlation, it's really small and statistically insignificant. The effect on the next day's open to close return, the normal return, is also statistically insignificant. Well, where does this correlation in the open to open return come from? Well, what's interesting is it's actually driven by yesterday's futures open to close return. That's correlated with the news. What's interesting about that, though, is the news can't cause that, since it occurred the day before. So there's causality here has to go the other way. That, in fact, partly what's going on is that the surveying is going on while the trading is still taking place. Well, there's a third way to check whether or not this news has an impact, and that's to go out and run an econometric model on the determinants of spot prices and the determinants of futures prices and add the news to that equation and see if it better explains the spot price changes. Well, it turns out if you do that, if you run what economists would call a vector error correcting model of simultaneously determining spot price changes and futures changes, that news has no impact on the spot prices, and it has no statistical impact on the futures prices. So in this particular case, despite what might have seemed like a plausible impact, just in some general sense, when you do the economic and the econometric analysis, it's very difficult to isolate that. And in some sense, I think economics in this case shows that particular allegation of manipulation is probably not warranted.
It's really fascinating. When is fraud not fraud? when you talk about the increase in volatility on the storage release reports, I was immediately brought to mind of the first time I understood commodities trading, the Eddie Murphy, Dan Aykroyd movie Trading Places.
That's a great example.
A fabulous, fabulous moment, at least for me intellectually, where I could say, okay, that's what it does. Sharon, up to you.
Well, thanks very much. I remember because basically he explained it by putting breakfast, setting the breakfast table and putting the eggs and the the coffee. Yeah, I tell you, it is a fascinating market, and I think it's really a pleasure for Robert and I to be here, sort of coming from the futures side of the equation as a asset market, and have a chance to talk to the securities professionals in the SEC Historical Society, because I think you know, I've always felt that derivatives do need a little extra explanation and understanding. My talk is on market manipulation, managing regulatory and legal risk. And the reason I selected this as my topic is many may know I served as a commissioner and acting chairman at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission before I joined NERA. And I wanted to sort of give companies and entities participating in the market and even you know, the public, a way to better understand the environment in which traders operate, especially in the futures context, and also how regulators view the world. Regulators, as Robert mentioned before, they have been investigating market manipulation in various markets, but there's been a specific focus recently in the energy area. Some cases that were brought by my agency when I was there, the British Petroleum cases in crude oil, gas, propane, AEP, Duke, Reliant, El Paso, Dynegy, and many others were brought for the conduct related to natural gas misreporting. And, of course, recently we've seen the CFTC jointly with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission bringing a case against hedge fund Amaranth and its traders. Well, when I was appointed to my post as regulator 5 years ago, I had the pleasure of working with some really amazing enforcement attorneys, all the way up to the Corporate Fraud Task Force and Jim Comey and Bill McDonough at the PCAOB. And I, you know, one thing that I would say is, beginning with Enron and continuing even today, the government has really, you know, brought it to a more rigorous and high level for pursuing companies for alleged manipulation, particularly in the energy complex, but in all asset classes. Now, and not only are these their cases that have been brought in the traditional boundaries of the various agencies' jurisdictions, there has been a drive to expand into new territories with, for example, the futures market regulator looking beyond the exchange-traded futures market to the over-the-counter markets. And I think, again, we see that in the Amaranth case where the one case that was brought by the CFTC, all of the conduct appears to have occurred in the over-the-counter and cash markets. And the CFTC has also frequently reassured Congress that it's requested and received daily position data regarding firms' activities in the over-the-counter markets. So we see that they're sort of flexing beyond their traditional boundaries. And the other agency that I'll mention, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, also sees futures activity as sufficiently in connection with its jurisdictional mandate to implement routine real-time monitoring in the futures markets. And so they've looked beyond their traditional authority in the wholesale markets and set their sights on financial markets, including the futures markets. And not only are these regulatory agencies watching trading activity in markets outside their jurisdiction, they're in some sense also eyeing each other. If you look at the recent cases that have been brought, you can see a great deal of cooperation and working together to bring these actions. And I think that this, again, is part of a progression that started, you know, earlier, say 5 or so years ago, where we realized that agencies can accomplish a great deal more when they work together. Well, they also take somewhat different approaches. I would say the CFTC is always focus their emphasis on trying to find where prices are artificial, in some sense not reflecting underlying market conditions. The FERC, given their traditional role of protecting consumers from what were purported monopoly gas and power companies, they focused on a somewhat more subjective standard, whether a price is just and reasonable. Well, both scores for these standards are continuously being written, but a key point is that they're fundamentally economic in nature. Regulators enforcing them use economic tools to monitor the markets and identify unusual prices. And the companies who are in the sites would benefit greatly if they, too, were able to employ the same tools to help manage their own regulatory and legal risks, to sort of know what the regulator knows about their trading. That way they can respond proactively to the changing regulatory environment. They can know who and what agencies are monitoring their activities and be prepared to respond to inquiries. For example, firms trading extensively in multiple markets can better manage their regulatory and legal risk if they focus their internal compliance resources on that type of their trading activities. And they can be more cost-effective in their expenditures on compliance. And I'm kind of suggesting is, you know, you should the companies should consider or may consider a risk-focused trading surveillance program. And so how would you do that? Well, as a former regulator, I should admit that, you know, when I was at the CFTC, we had a really amazing stable of economists who devoted a lot of time and resources to monitoring the markets. And they focused on time periods that displayed unusual prices and price relationships. So one type of surveillance program that would help companies to prepare would do the same thing by surveying all the days in a systematic manner, by identifying those days that the regulators would also consider unusual, and then prioritizing those days for further internal investigation. That way, a company will be better prepared to manage their regulatory and legal risks going forward. Well, how would a program identify these periods? Well, I think first a program would look at the basic market factors like prices and other factors that regulators consider. You could look at them directly to see where the change observed falls within a historical distribution, what we call an unconditional review, to see if these prices and these economic factors are unusual. Then the factors should be put in context, some kind of model of underlying economics to see if, given that review, they're still unusual. So what we've kind of thought is what you could use an economic model to determine what might explain the market moves. This defines a conditional distribution that says, okay, given these relationships, given this level of volatility, is this price unusual? And then now you've been able to screen on two levels, the unconditional, the conditional, and you've been able to identify some unusual days that are likely to receive additional regulatory scrutiny. Once you've got them, though, you might want to go ahead and do sort of related to Robert's talk, there might be some market news or information out there, some economic event or just a supply and demand related factor that caused that day to be unusual. But in either case, after you've kind of identified them, screened them, and checked to see if there were any news events that may explain them, it would allow you to then take what's left and rank them based on how unusual and whether you need to do some further scrutinizing of the trading activities. Now, market factors, well, certainly you want to examine market factors in both the futures and cash market. So if you're thinking about what are you considering, what are you going to evaluate, look at market factors. So you might also want to look at some non-price information that tends to be of interest to regulators. Since we're interested in market dominance, control of supply, or large positions, we also would tend to want to look at physical positions, the positions in the cash and over-the-counter derivatives markets, and you'd also want to look at market concentration. And the first variables most relevant for review, I think, would include looking at changes in spot prices, changes in futures prices, changes in the spot futures basis. In other words, there's a sort of regular relationship between the spot and futures, and the calendar spread between the near month and the second month maturities. Then the data are examined in critical areas, and you'll look at the number of deliveries, the size of trader positions relative to the market, and the volatility. You could take, after doing this, you could register these results on a scorecard where you keep track of those days that display unusual levels for the various values. And it, as an illustration, consider the daily change in the basis for a commodity for a few months. The basis is the difference between the futures and spot price. You could plot those daily values and note those cases that were outside the normal range for those that the change exceeded that of what it is 90% of the time. Those outside the historical distribution could be marked on your scorecard as you keep track of those unusual days. And similarly, you could do that in your conditional model. That, as you recall, I mentioned you'd build an economic model that put those days in context that would capture the relationships among the various market factors that might influence their variables. As we use a vector error correction model that basically looks at the same unconditional variables but recognizes that they're really interrelated and that what happened yesterday affects what happens today. And again, you set up some level of confidence intervals where you would see where they're outside a historical value and determine whether or not they're outliers in this conditional model. Once you apply the economic model to see whether it's predicted by the economics, that'll help you to determine whether these days should be worthy of additional screening. Well, and then, as I mentioned, you would check on those days that you had flagged based on the news that may have occurred. There might be things like a pipeline explosion or a hurricane warning or a bad weather report that may give rise to the unusual pricing behavior. And that would allow you to rank them according to sort of the good, the bad, and the ugly, the latter being the unusual and unexplained by economic conditions or the news. At this juncture, we're kind of there. You've got what regulators have, a view of what was going on in the markets that can be used to help prepare for potential scrutiny and also demonstrates knowledge of market factors at work that may help explain trader activities. One possible use of this sort of risk-based surveillance protocol would be for internal compliance. After you've identified the days that are likely to be suspect, a review could be done to see whether the firm's traders were active in the market or whether regulatory authorities would be calling. If they were, compliance may wish to inquire about their activities, their strategies, and their overall aims in the market. If that raises concerns, then the firm may want to review P&L records, perhaps review trading records and tapes and emails. But I think the key conclusion that I would say is, if you bring a sort of focused surveillance program that's on par with the regulatory authorities, companies, managers, the board even, it would have a mechanism in place that better prepares them to navigate the markets, which is characterized by increased regulatory scrutiny and legal risk.
Sharon, that was really interesting and good advice, starting with the age-old premise, know your enemy. Certainly sounds like if you were to adopt your programs, there'd be little need for regulators since you'd be replicating the regulatory system in-house. I have questions for all of you. Robert and Pat, I sort of have a question that has a basic relationship, the two related questions, but I'll start with Robert. It sounds like in this particular study, you may have discovered the economist's holy grail of the perfect market, the perfectly efficient market. Is that true? Does your research really suggest that? And if so, what kind of regulatory regime should govern a market that works so neatly that the main formal source of news is essentially irrelevant?
Interesting question. It does turn out that if you actually run the regressions and estimate the model, that the natural gas futures markets appears to be quite an efficient market. That is, it's basically a random walk, as you would expect with an efficient stock market. And it doesn't respond to yesterday's spot price. It actually responds to surprise weather and surprise storage reports. And then it incorporates in an efficient way the real news that comes into the market. I think the critical point here is that publication, some people might like to think that that's the market's primary source of that information. That's just one source of that information. Traders are sitting at their desk all day watching prices. They're seeing the prices. They're making the prices. So when that report comes out, only a part of that is news. Right? And in fact, if one were to take that...
Well, actually, listening to you, it sounds to me like no part of that is really news.
In fact, in this particular case, the news had no systematic effect. That's right. Whatever. There was difference. There was a difference between that report and the benchmark we constructed.
So the publisher has some kind of threat value and is just collecting rents.
I shouldn't say that. The indexes are used for important purposes. They're used as a way of settling certain contracts, right? Because it's just like you create any index, and then a basis contract may well settle off of that. Mm-hmm. Now, whether there's some legitimate complaint that, oh, you affected that index at this far delivery point in Malin, and when I settled my cash contract, I didn't get paid the right amount of money, that's a totally different question than I was talking about. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about, did that misreport at Malin have an impact on the futures market? We didn't find that. Okay? So it's a distant, but I believe, in fact, the natural gas futures market is a very efficient market.
Do you have, sorry, Charlotte?
Oh, I just would just add, you know, I think what you've mentioned and sort of summarized is that markets serve this very important role, which is price discovery. And this is, you know, it shows that a great deal of price discovery occurred before the Platts Index was ever published. And, you know, so it really is just a summary of the price discovery that the market had already engaged in.
This really is absolutely fascinating. Pat, do you have anything to add to this? Any question?
It's hard to parallel, but we find with analyst reports, right, a lot of times there's no reaction with analyst reports. In fact, I think one of the biggest purchasers of analyst reports are now us, historically, going back and figure out what the analyst said during certain company announcements. They used to give us a lot of analysts for free, old ones, and now they realize that we actually need these for litigation purposes a lot. But I think it's the same general thing, right, that that kind of news is already in there, and even, you know, most of the analyst reports are kind of in line with each other.
Well, this is actually relates to, I had good questions written down, but it relates to none of your particular presentations, but to all of what you've just said. And let's talk about the stock market for a second. I understand. And, of course, economists talk about the markets as being price discovery mechanisms. Of course, the stock market was originally a capital allocation mechanism, a capital raising mechanism, which it in no respect is really in any significant way at this point. When we talk about price discovery in a futures market where you've got actual deliverable commodities, it seems to me that that makes very good sense. Does it make as much sense to talk about the stock market as a price discovery mechanism when we know that the stock market has significant impacts, for example, on the behavior of corporate governance, on corporate cost of capital and like?
Well, I mean, I can start, I guess, but certainly I think our history is very short, right? When the IPO rage was all going on, prices were opening and then taking off. Right, so clearly was price discovery. What people were setting the opening price at was very different than.
Right.
So, I mean, I think in short term there was a lot.
But in
of
a longer price. Historical view, that's not the case, right? When you're talking about a real bubble period.
Mm-hmm. I guess how you chop it up, right? Now there are a lot of small companies that are going public with pipes, reverse mergers, all these types of things that are using it as a main axis of capital, and how those prices are set. I mean, clearly for big companies that have so much financial information and fixed income securities that they've got out, and there's not a lot of knowledge, you know, you're going to get from the equities. But maybe dividing it up into smaller companies, and maybe part of the answer will be as we become more international globally in the markets that, you know, we'll be accessing information cross-border that way more efficiently. Maybe it will help. Mm-hmm. Certainly the problem with fixed income is they really don't trade. So you don't really have any time you try and look at price reactions to bonds. It's difficult to figure it out because there's no trading.
Right.
So we go to the equity market to find out when something's material. Because we can find out quickly how the market perceives that materiality.
Interesting. Look, one question I had for you based on your presentation is this. Even to somebody who considers himself to be marginally sophisticated, the mechanisms of trading are enormously complex. And you did a beautiful job of explaining that complexity in a fairly comprehensible way. I was able to follow every step of it. But you're talking about something that is massively complicated, that occurs at virtually blinding speed, and is really, the numbers are constantly moving. They're hard to track. Given that kind of trading environment, how can you distinguish between an honest specialist and a specialist who isn't playing by the rules? The implication listening to you is at least that some economic analysis of specialist trading would lead us to think that we just simply have to suck it up, accept that there's going to be some dishonesty in the specialist market, have some rules for really egregious violations, and just kind of ride it as it is. There's not much we can do about it from a regulatory standpoint. Is that true?
Tough question. I guess in my opinion, I would answer it two ways. One, I'm a less regulation versus more regulation person because I think markets are very good at figuring out those inefficiencies. And anytime we try and put regulations, you're pretty much inviting people to find ways to get around them and come up with new paths. In fact, probably one of the reasons you find it so complicated is because regulations have been put on top of each other to deal with the fact that the NYSE for a long time has not embraced new technology. So now when new technology is coming in, dot trading is getting very fast, decimalization, you know, takes place, it's growing pains, right, till people get used to a new system. Eventually, rules will be taken away as quickly as they are put. You can see all the specialist companies now, most of them are taking very large charges right now against future earnings because they just simply don't see this as the way.
Can I build on your question?
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask Pat, you started out in your talk talking about trading ahead and interpositioning, and then you very quickly stop talking about trading ahead, and you only talked about interpositioning. Why was that?
Trading ahead proved to be a very difficult thing for all parties to get their hands around in terms of damages. Again, it goes back to your rules, but quickly the government dropped the trading ahead allegations against the specialists they were taking to trial. Whether that was because they felt they only needed the interpositioning allegations, or they felt it was complicated to come up with a number. And it goes right back to your question, which is, part of the trading ahead allegations where they were always profitable whenever the specialist traded ahead. However, there are rules on the New York Stock Exchange dictating when the specialist can trade based on the previous tick that almost mandated that it be a profitable trade. So it's never again quite clear cut how it's going to be and for whatever strategy reasons they decided.
That's an interesting comment because about a decade ago I worked on a case in which there was trading ahead of a commodity trading firm. The firm's strategy was being called outside the firm. And this was at the sentencing stage, so we were supposed to figure out how much damage was done. And it was hard to come up with a big number because the markets were incredibly liquid and the trades ahead were fairly small, so they probably didn't damage the market much, but they still made money.
Right.
So I can imagine that being a difficult empirical exercise.
Right, and I think the amounts were very small.
Yeah.
Interesting phrase, didn't damage the market much. And Pat, I'm going to stay with you for another minute. Sharon, you gave Pat the thumbs up when he said markets are pretty good and adjust pretty quickly. And while that may very well be true, of course, we know that that's true on a macro level, right? The markets will adjust. But we still have the possibility that individual traders are going to be hurt during this market adjustment period. Some of that is rules of the game, right? You've got better information than somebody else. Some people win, some people lose. But when you introduce irregularities, perhaps, advantages that ordinary people might consider unfair, somebody like me, for example, how can an economist help us address that particular problem? Or, as again, maybe I'm hammering the question, but I come back to, is this something we simply have to live with and it's part of the cost of doing business?
Well, I guess the one key word that we're missing when we talk about markets is they're competitive markets. And, you know, you enter and utilize markets as a means to, I mean, why are we all using the securities markets? I'm sure it is so that we can grow our nest egg to make money. I mean, that's what we're trying to do. And everyone in that market is seeking to do so. Unless there's a certain rule that enables, or a certain market structure that enables one participant to gain market power at the disadvantage of another, which for many years people have thought the specialist system, conveyed market power.
It almost structurally does, doesn't it?
Yeah. But whose fault is that? I mean, where does it come from? It actually had been endowed for a long time by regulation itself because it was thought that you needed a specialist to have an orderly marketplace. So in some sense, from a regulatory perspective, we actually sow the seeds of the unfairness in our actions, and I think that's something that we all have to be cognizant of in regulation, both securities and futures.
And well, let me give you a little push and pull with that, which
sure.
is when we went from ticks to decimals,
mm-hmm.
that was a good thing. Spreads mm-hmm. closed, but part of a side effect of that was that limit orders didn't get executed quite as quickly because it was easier for people to compete with them. Okay, so what's the net benefit of that? Very difficult to figure out, but you wouldn't argue with me that we should have stayed with ticks and not moved to decimals because it would have introduced some new inefficiency that's going to take time
right.
for us to figure out how to get around.
No, of course not.
So.
But this leads sort of perhaps to the ultimate question, especially given the changes in trading technology we've seen over the last couple of decades. Is it time to get rid of the whole floor trading system and the specialist system?
I think John Thayne would probably be better at commenting on it, but the New York just went to a hybrid system,
mm-hmm.
and so maybe eventually that'll happen. Certainly, ECNs took over a large portion of the trading from NASDAQ.
Right.
So,
and if we did that, that would eliminate even the possibility of structural unfairness and smooth, and presumably, from an economist standpoint, smooth the market. Right.
Yeah, and I think it's also interesting. My view is that you sort of let those things occur naturally because these are fundamentally business decisions of the markets themselves,
right.
and the
SEC's
companies.
National Market Program never really got going by mandate, did it?
In my view is that you can't think of all the possibilities of how a market operates because it is so complex. So the idea that a regulator could design a market has always created consternation in my mind. I'd rather allow the markets to evolve naturally toward a more efficient microstructure, and that being electronic.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be occurring. It certainly is occurring in the equities markets, and it is occurring rapidly in the futures markets as well.
Well, let's take off from that a little bit and go to a question I had for you. I was interested to hear the way you cast your talk. I understand why you did, as risk management, right? Basically, model the way the regulators model. Be prepared for the inquiries the regulators are going to have. Be prepared to defend yourself by knowing how to explain or explain away the irregularities that you see. But one thing that I was thinking as you were describing what sounded to me like a wonderful internal compliance program is you could, in effect, and I was only half joking at the end of your talk, you could, in effect, almost eliminate the regulator if you could use that internal compliance program, or I guess this is really a question. What is the likelihood that such an internal compliance program will be preventive medicine rather than ex post facto risk management, so that the very knowledge that such a system is in place would, do you think that this has the potential to avoid the kinds of irregularities in the first place?
I think that's a very good question. It's funny, in my many opportunities to testify before Congress, I know that they would ask me, you know, it's great you have these surveillance and monitoring systems, but you only catch the bad guys after the fact. What can you do to prevent manipulation and fraud? And you're right, this type of self-regulatory program, if you will, this internal compliance really does, I think, help business self-monitor, regulate, and make sure. I mean, if you look at a lot of cases, I've been at NERA only a year, but I've seen that in a lot of cases, companies are as unaware of some of their trader activities, you know, as others. I mean, they don't, you know, traders kind of go, it's an interesting business. You know, it's a very competitive world to be a floor trader or to be a trader of any kind. Things happen rapidly. It's complex. The strategies are complex. Companies, especially senior management, need a mechanism that they can better monitor trader activities. When are they causing unusual pricing days? When could they be attaining market power that could unduly influence the market price and the efficiency of the market that could lead to regulatory action? I think it actually becomes almost a corporate governance kind of issue. It's very important to have those tools.
Now,
can I just add to that, too, because I think it's, in some sense, the answer to Congress to the question they were asking you is, I mean, the existence of the CFTC surveillance program, the existence of the NYMEX surveillance program does deter. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it catches some and you bring investigations, but it also deters others from doing it, just as I think the type of program you've described, if that was applied and traders knew that the legal compliance department had that sort of information, it would probably discourage people who might otherwise be inclined to do it from doing certain things they shouldn't do. So I think both at the government level and at the firm level, it has a strong deterrent effect.
Well, I never like to tweak economists. I'd like to follow that up with yet another question, though, and that is the incentives of companies to adopt these programs. Because it, both for the companies themselves and their individual employees, if the employees are compensated in a way that the cost of an occasional misbehavior is less than what they might make from misbehaving sufficiently and not getting caught, or if the aggregate profits to the firm are such from kind of turning a bit of a blind eye to misbehavior so that when you get caught, yeah, we got a regulatory fine, we've got a penalty, it's a little embarrassing, but hey, everybody gets embarrassed at some point. Are the incentives really there to put in this kind of internal strong compliance, or are the profits from noncompliance too great?
Well, I think, you know, I believe they are. I mean, because again, I have great deal of confidence in the enforcement staffs and the sort of regulatory, you know, you come from a regulatory program recently, you believe that you have a very tough and aggressive mechanism to catch bad guys. And if we don't catch them, I mean, we knew that somebody would report them in the competitive market realm. So you felt that was really an important aspect that would help, that would, you know, and certainly knowing that, you know, of course there have been many studies that say less than 20% get caught who commit wrongdoing, and maybe it's a numbers game, you know, ultimately. But I think that after Enron and after a lot of the terrible, you know, behavior that we saw, companies really have recognized how important it is to be on top of their trading program, to operate in an ethical manner with a high level of integrity in their trading and in their dealings with in the markets and in their dealings with their investors. So I think that there's more. I'm sort of over optimistic, but I think that there really is a desire on the part of most firms, especially in the energy area now, given the occurrences that we've seen over the last few years, to really demonstrate that they've cleaned up their act and really take extra precautions to avoid the scrutiny of the regulatory authorities, which, by the way, is very costly, right? I mean, responding to the legal and regulatory costs are huge.
Well, Sharon, I'm going to leave you with that optimistic last word on the state of corporate America. Sharon Patton, Robert, thank you for sharing these presentations from NERA Economic Consulting's recent seminar. They were absolutely fascinating, and I can see why you've been asked to be with us today. Again, I'd like to thank NERA Economic Consulting for sponsoring today's program. The Best of NERA 2007 is now archived in audio format in the Virtual Museum, so you can listen again to the discussion at any time. A transcript of the discussion, as well as the audio in MP3 format, will be accessioned in the online programs section in the coming months. The SEC Historical Society will resume its online programs this fall with a fireside chat on the accounting aspects of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Please join us online at www.sechistorical.org on Tuesday, September 18th, for a discussion with Philip Amin, General Electric Company, and SEC Chief Accountant Conrad Hewitt, moderated by my good friend and colleague, Professor Teresa Gabaldon from the GW Law School. Thank you all again for being with us here today.
Thank you.